Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
John Wotton is probably best known for his acclaimed Inspector Troy series, but in his new novel, Then We Take Berlin, he's written a thrilling standalone. In the new novel, we meet Joe Wilderness, a World War II orphan who thinks his troubled upbringing excuses him from common morality. Wilderness has no intention of getting drafted, but in 1946 he finds himself in the Royal Air Force, facing a stretch in military prison, when along comes Lieutenant Colonel Burne Jones to tell him MI6 has better use of his talents. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe. Gets me out of the house.
Very nice to have you here and in our house for the moment. Before we talk about the novel itself, give us a sense of the liberation that comes in stepping aside from Inspector Troy.
I'm not fed up with the guy, but you're saying in your delightfully roundabout way that I needed a break from him, and you're quite right. Not a total break. He crops up on a single page as a minor character. The pleasure was in the experiment. It was to look what you'd done. And to be honest, I never read anything I've written. I leave that to others. I went back to the very first novel, 1992, and picked up on a minor character and thought, supposing he becomes the protagonist of a novel. Yeah, there was a certain freedom in doing that, and then I was a few pages in and realized he was not a lead character. So the real freedom was coming up with something completely different.
Right. And with that something completely different comes a new character, and as you mentioned, there is a freedom. So when you explore that character, that is what is different, because certainly the time period, certainly much of the surroundings are the same.
My London editor came up with a brilliant tag. This is a Troy novel without Troy. The vocabulary is the same, the time setting is the same. The lead character could not be more different. He's a working class kid from the East End of London, whereas Troy is Harrow educated, turned down a place at Oxford, and comes from the Russian aristocracy. Polar opposites pretty well. Plus, Troy's 5 foot five and Wilderness is 6 foot two.
there's the height difference.
I allowed myself to grow for this book.
This troubled upbringing that he has really shapes who he is as a person.
Yeah. Child is father to the man is about as true as you can get.
And with that comes, it makes him scrappier. It makes him a little more world-weary and world-ready, I guess.
I'd say it makes him very grown up at the age of 17 or 18. Life didn't allow him much of a childhood. And when he gets into the RAF, he's 18, they didn't take them any younger, he behaves much more like an adult than I'd anticipated, and slowly the logic of that came home to me. Yes, I grew up in a world where you were allowed to be a child. The word teenager was invented for my generation. There were none before us. This is someone who didn't get to be a teenager. An 18-year-old is a young man, not a teenager.
Lacking this maturity of years, but certainly with life experience, and life has smacked him around quite a bit.
His father's smacked him around quite a bit. When you said he's an orphan, he's orphaned at about 13. His old man really lays into him in one or two scenes. And that's a brutal childhood, but to be honest, fairly typical of England in those days.
And it's in reading that is really troublesome, because you sort of see the character kind of slipping from any normalcy.
Yeah, the rules don't apply to Joe Wilderness.
So what makes him MI6 material?
The RAF was the only branch of the British Armed Services that had you sit an entrance exam. Now, considering they were still, even in 1945-6, conscripting the 18-year-olds at the rate of knots, the guys who served in the war were being discharged. They were calling up the younger generation for the war that wasn't there to fight anymore. And if you applied for the RAF, one of the tests was for your IQ. Hence, the secret services, who wanted the brightest and the best, to distort a well-known American phrase, I think it was the best and the brightest, though, knew exactly who to look for when they read the test results. And I based this on one of my own tutors when I was in college, who'd been taken from a factory where he made bicycles, to the RAF, to Cambridge, and made to learn Russian and German with the question, what you want to do, son? You want to learn to be a spy, or you want to carry on square bashing? It's a non-choice. You don't need to think about it twice. Led to a very good career for him. I ended up working with him when I was in television myself because he became our TV station's Kremlin watcher. His Russian was still so good, even in retirement.
Mm. What is it about Berlin, especially in this time period, that draws you to it?
I got there by an oblique route. My father's war ended in 45 in Hamburg, which was in the British sector. He described to me how it was a free-for-all. Everybody took anything that wasn't nailed down. And one of his stories I actually put in the book, which was how an RAF pilot managed to winch a yacht out of the Baltic into the bomb bay of his plane and drop it back down in the English Channel where his mates rescued it. Theft on a quite colossal scale. Hence, my hero first gets to Germany via Hamburg. I just knew in my bones that Berlin is going to be Hamburg times 1,000 because of the four forces that met in that city, three of whom had one agenda, one of whom had a totally different agenda. And what I saw the possibility was, supposing they collaborated, and I have a Russian NKVD major, a US Army intelligence captain, Joe Wilderness, who's a corporal by this time, and an artillery lance bombardier, all with different talents to bring to the smuggling game. And I think few cities on earth have ever been quite so ripe for smuggling and black marketeering as Berlin was between the German surrender and the building of the wall.
In thinking about that period, and you have a knowledge, you have a familial knowledge, what were there, I assume there were very definite blanks that you wanted to fill in the history.
Oh, yeah. I got very lucky. From the previous novels, I have a shelf of books, you know, a cupboard full, hundreds, on the war itself. It occurred to me that the immediate post-war era isn't well considered. And almost as soon as I formed the thought, books by serious historians started appearing. I think I counted 7 in the 3 years I was writing the book, all devoted to Europe after the German surrender. It actually made the job of research for this book easier than it's been for most of the others. They simply poured data at me. There's even one out from my own publisher next month. It's going on. The shocking thing, and the thing that really got me hooked in trying to find out the detail of life in post-war Germany, was to find out that once we'd stopped shooting at one another, people carried on dying by the millions. And I don't think I'd clocked that. We took Belsen. The Americans took Dachau. The population of Belsen, when the gates opened, was 40,000. A month later, it was 28,000. That's 12,000 people dead in 1 month without a shot fired. And the most shocking statistic of all, nobody wanted to surrender to the Russians. So by the Christmas of 45, there were 12 million people in motion in Central Europe. I think that's the biggest displacement of people in the history of the planet.
In thinking about that loss of life and that incredible statistic is that it always remains. I mean, you start the book out in the 60s, and it continues to be a troubled place.
Yeah. The book's bracketed by events that take place in 1963, about which I'll say no more because I think the operative word here would be spoiler.
Mm.
But I was looking for what it was that turned my MI6 agent into a civilian again, and it was a very, very famous still photo. And people say, where do you get your ideas from? The question you most hate to be asked. But in this case, still photographs are such fertile ground. And it was an old woman in her 70s called Frieda Schultz, hanging by her wrists from a building right on the line between the French sector and the Russian sector, with the East Germans pulling it back up and the West Germans trying to pull it down, to the point where you can see up an old lady's skirt. Just an unfathomably shameless shot. And he looks at this. He's there actually for LBJ's vice presidential visit to Berlin. The two practically coincided. And thinks, well, if this is what it's all coming down to, looking at an old lady's frock, count me out. And he resigns at that point, which generates the two brackets, the 63 brackets for it. The middle of the book is the growth of this man as a criminal and as a spy. The two are inseparable. He is one because he's the other and vice versa.
How much do you consider yourself, obviously having been a journalist and investigating this time period, of being a historian, of looking into this time and wanting to know more about the war?
Bat the word gently back to you rather than accept it, because I don't think there's a lot of original research in what I do. I'm dependent upon people far better than me. One of my earlier books, Second Violin, is set largely in the British internment camps, whereby we imprisoned every foreign national, Italians, Germans, Austrians, and eventually Hungarians, to the point where you couldn't get a decent bowl of pasta in London, because nobody was there to cook it.
Mm-hmm.
That began with a piece of original research. I was just talking to an old man one day from Vienna who'd been there. He'd been part of that. Cross-reference that with my publisher's experience. George Weidenfeld was my publisher in those days, who's a Viennese. And I thought, I'll ask him, George, why weren't you rounded up? Oh, it's far too valuable to them, dear boy. I worked for the propaganda unit of the BBC. And here and there, if you can follow a thread, you can do original research by the people you talk to. But of course, survivors of that war are very, very old people now. There aren't that many of them left. And one of the real problems with original research is how unreliable human memory can be. I talk to a lot of survivors of the Blitz whose memories are more than slightly contradicted by the historical record. People reconstruct. Memory is a partial work of fiction. I'd need to work a lot harder to make an original contribution to history, so I'm flattered you think I might be an historian, but I'm going to refuse the title.
I can understand the refusal, and yet the journalism must come in handy.
Yeah, I was in arts and current affairs for about 10 years. It left me in no way intimidated talking to anyone. I came up in a school of hard knocks. The first person I ever had to try and interview was Ed Koch. Sitting with his backside on the Bethesda Fountain in Central Park, and I'm tentatively going towards him with the microphone. My producer says, nah, he don't want to do that. And he elbows one reporter in the ribs. Other side, elbows another reporter in the ribs, pushes me forward and goes, Mr. Mayor, a comment. And the two guys guarding Ed Koch just got their guns wrapped in T-shirts just in case there's any trouble. I also learned very rapidly not to be scared of the bodyguards if you could help it. And I also got to work with people I wouldn't have dreamt I'd ever meet. I think I'm probably the last journalist ever to interview Jerzy Kosinski before his suicide. An interview I never got to use. I worked extensively with Gore Vidal. Indeed, the book is dedicated to him. I think I said something like, the world has lost its greatest pain in the ass. The post is now vacant for Gore Vidal, who helped kick me into shape. Well, he did. To my first book, he sent me a note. You know, you write one a year, you could take control of your life. Well, I can't write one a year. Sorry, Gore.
Why was he so good?
As a person, he was hugely intolerant. He's not fond of humanity at the best of times. His prose style, I think, is impeccable. I've rarely met an intellect as capacious as Gore Vidal's. I mean, the man had no education after about the age of 15 except what he gave himself. And he could out-talk just about any professor on the planet. My daydream, as I'd worked with both of them and they'd never met, was for him to go with Noam Chomsky. They eventually met, but not through my offices. And I found just the other day, it's on YouTube. I shall be watching that as soon as I get home. Yesterday, in one of the panels, Peter Rozavsky asked me to name the pre-95 book that I would consider most influential. I had no hesitation in saying Myron. Although I think, Gore, if you're listening, sorry, not up there, Gore, if you're listening down there, He would have said Myra Breckinridge, which is his 67 novel, because he said to me once, you know, before Myra there was the novel. After Myra, the novel was something else. Myron, the sequel, I know he was personally very, very proud of, and I think he was flattered when I said, well, actually, it's my favorite amongst what you've done, which is about Myra Breckinridge, after she's reverted to the male gender, falling into a cathode ray tube and rewriting history.
So there's this person who may be in hell, and yet...
Can you hear us down there, Gaul?
And yet still an influence to you.
Yes, huge.
I mean, I think someone you weren't from.
He was irreplaceable. When it came to the nearest thing he had to retirement, which was to move back to the States from Europe... Howard, his longtime companion, had died. There's no way he was going to stay in Italy without him. I suggested that he move to Georgetown, hold court at the Four Seasons in Foggy Bottom every lunchtime, and I said, you know, the American press will be the path to your door. He grew up in Washington. I don't think he was fond of it, and settled for California instead. He could have had 8 years of poking fun at George Bush Jr., but he resisted it.
When you think of... This gets back to you not linking yourself to the term historian, and yet both you and Gore Vidal have those labels of historical fiction.
Yeah, that I can live with. I work hard at it. I think it most unlikely I will ever set a novel in my own adult life. Although the one that's out a year from now, I'll be about 19 when it's set, but it's the central character is, again, 10 or 12 years older than I am myself. It's also the only one I've written set here.
In the States.
Yeah. So if I get my slang wrong, someone will be writing to me. At least I hope they do. I don't mind being corrected.
Well, the name of the book is Then We Take Berlin. It is published by Grove Atlantic. And John Wadden, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
As they say up north, thanks for having me. I'll get me coat.
Thank you very much. Again, the title, Then We Take Berlin by John Wadden. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.